Welcome to the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. I'm your host, David Yosefan, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law in sunny Santa Clara, California. In this episode of the podcast, we examine the question of international or transnational or global corporate social responsibility. It's a very challenging subject area. It can be dizzying to turn one's mind and attention to the literature that has developed in this area. The conceptual issues are themselves very, very challenging. I'm grateful that we have the opportunity to think them through and talk them through today with a leading expert in the field. Please subscribe to us on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at David Yosefan. That's at David Yosefon. At David Yosefan, and I will tweet it out anytime I'm posting a new episode in this podcast series. We are sponsored by the Markla Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, and we are grateful for their sponsorship. With me now is Larry Kata-Backer. Larry is the W. Richard and Mary Eshelman Faculty Scholar and Professor of Law and International Affairs at Penn State's Dickinson School of Law. Professor Backer is an internationally recognized scholar on globalization issues with a specialty in understanding the intersection of constitutional issues and enterprise law issues. I'm a big fan of Professor Backer's work, and I want to note, Larry, that I think your scholarship evidences a very rare quality of showing a willingness to grapple with the minutiae of regulatory regimes while also evidencing an ability to then step back and deal with the most abstract theoretical problems or issues that minutia is drawing out or structuring or responding to. So thank you for being a part of the podcast, Larry.
Well, I'm very grateful for your interest, and I'm looking forward to a great conversation.
So, Larry, you have just returned from Geneva, where you were engaged in a consultation for the Working Group on Business and Human Rights. Can you tell us what that enterprise is and what came out of it?
Well, sure. Over the course of the last, and I'll make this fairly short, although it's like everything else involving business and human rights, it tends to be somewhat complicated in its history. But over the course of the last 6 or so years, under a mandate from the UN Secretary General and being run by John Ruggie, a professor at the Kennedy School at Harvard, the UN developed through a series of multi-stakeholder engagements and the like, a very, very interesting new approach to global, not so much regulation as global principles for business and human rights. These were reduced to a set of general principles that were endorsed by the UN Human Rights Council in the summer of 2011. And at the time that they endorsed these general principles on business and human rights, they also created a working group made up of experts that were geographically, that represented most of the geography of the globe, a working group to work through implementing and operationalizing the guiding principles. The working group has been in existence now, 3 years. I think their mandate is going to be renewed. I haven't heard anything that suggests they aren't. And they've been very busy trying to work through a set of implementation. There are others around the world who are doing this as well. There's big elements of civil society that are working this in different areas. But the working group is sort of where the focus of the of public international bodies is. And one of the things that they've been working on recently has been and I have to back up here, and again, I apologize. The explanation is longer than I would have liked, but there are a lot of pieces to this puzzle.
Well, we want the deep story. So you please go ahead and give it to us.
All right. the guiding principles themselves are divided into what everyone now calls three pillars.
Can I even step back just one step back even further to make clear that when these principles that we're talking about were developed in response to a charge that was issued by the UN Secretary General back in 2005 to his special representative on the issue of human rights and transnational corporations, and these principles have developed out of that charge. Is that right?
That is absolutely right. Okay. That is absolutely right.
So now tell us about those principles as they've developed.
All right. And the principles are really grouped around three pillars, is what we call them, or really three themes. The first is a state duty to protect human rights, and that is really grounded in the traditional, formal, and customary venues of international law and the relationships of states to that in the context of developing global legal, international and national legal consensus about both the meaning, application, and implementation of human rights, quote-unquote, as law. The second pillar is directed to corporations themselves beyond the state, and this is a corporate responsibility to respect human rights. And this is centered on the idea that corporations ought not to do any harm. There's a specific group of international human rights norms to which corporations are expected to respond, that is to be responsible to in the International International Bill of Human Rights and a couple of the ILO conventions. And their responsibility is centered on a project of due diligence, what they call human rights due diligence. So they, being very sensitive to the human rights detrimental impacts of their action, which is discovered in the course of doing human rights due diligence in the specific context of those human rights norms that they have to be sensitive to. And then the third pillar, which applies both to corporate responsibility, which again is separate and is viewed as autonomous from any legal requirement in any particular state in which they operate. The remedial pillar then focuses both on the corporate responsibility to respect human rights and the state duty to protect human rights. And that essentially provides that both states and corporations have to have developed mechanisms for an effective remediation of human rights detrimental activity, right? And so that was the big picture and the framework. Over the last year or so, the working, again, to go back to the answer to the question, and again, I apologize, it's a long roundabout. Over the last year or so, the working group has sought to look at the state duty to protect human rights in much more carefully. And they've been looking for ways to develop capacities of states to actually embrace the normative duties in the state duty and to figure out ways that they can actually operationalize it. And what the way that they've determined to do that is to encourage states to develop what they call national action plans. That is a set of focused activities that look at these issues and try to figure out how states can deploy all of their various apparatus, their administration, their legislation, and the like, to meet their obligations under international law instruments as applicable within the state. And so what we did was we sat and tried to think of ways in which the working group might perhaps think about ways of building capacity in states to actually work through these issues, to map the sort of human rights obligations that they have, to figure out where they may lack some important human rights-related laws or regulations, and then to figure out how to actually implement them using their governmental resources. And that involved, of course, both the issue of figuring out what you have and then to figure out how you can actually use it in meaningful ways, both to order your own government and then to use it to help businesses which is the object of all of this, of course, to help businesses comply with their own human rights responsibilities. Mm-hmm. That's a mouthful, and I'm sorry about that, but it's really great stuff.
It's a mouthful of gold, so we're grateful for it. So I want to understand that the substantive human rights, the substantive rights that are being protected, respected, and remedied, these rights refer to a broader discourse or tradition of human rights law internationally that have developed in other contexts. So can you just say a little bit about what are the human rights that that states have a duty to protect people from having corporations violate, that corporations themselves have a duty to respect, and that both have a duty to remedy?
Right. Now, of course, now you have put your finger on one of the more contentious issues, mm-hmm. And one for which there is at least a core of consensus, of course, but in which there is perhaps in some areas a substantial amount I'll put it positively, of working towards consensus. Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with the state duty to protect human rights, you're as I mentioned before, you're dealing with the core of the traditional international norms of state obligations. And in this context, it comes up in two respects. States may be bound under international law with respect to other states to do or not do certain things with respect to treaties that they've signed, or just Kogan's obligations to which the community of states believes that they are subject, but that every state has, to some extent, some significant authority to determine which elements of international law they will embrace and which of those they will transpose into their domestic legal orders. So I'll give you an example. We all, in the United States, we're all big fans of human rights. Indeed, we're a pivotal actor in the construction of notions of transnational human rights regimes. We were there at the very beginning of this project in the end of the 1940s. But we have refused to sign the International Covenant on Social, Economic, and Cultural Rights. Mm-hmm. And not only have we failed to embrace them, we have refused to transpose those into our national law. Many European states have not only signed them, but have transposed them into their national law. So that when you're looking at, for example, the particular legally binding human rights that are binding, let's say, in the Netherlands, the group, and you map these rights out, the number and scope and kind and origin of those rights in the Netherlands may be very different, and perhaps to some extent broader, than those rights available in the United States. Now, of course, the Americans will come back and say, well, we don't really need to do this because we have functional equivalence and blah, blah, blah. And you can argue, and we spent a lot of time arguing about this stuff. But one of the key issues when you're dealing with human rights is indeed this question that when you're dealing with it as a lawyer, and you're dealing with it through the mechanics of mm-hmm. international law, most states will have a different set of quote-unquote rights and law to which they will bind themselves. And so it becomes very difficult to talk about human rights as a singularity in this context when there is substantial division. So for example, in the United States, we tend to value much more highly civil and political rights. In China, the state tends to value far more economic, social, and cultural rights, and they tend to bend their legal frameworks in that direction, which causes some differences among them. Beyond that, and please cut me off if I babble too long.
No.
Beyond that, you've got in the context of corporate responsibility, in a sense, you've got both a liberatory aspect and an implementation and enforcement difficulty. which is different from that faced by the states. In the states, you worry about, is there a right that you can enforce administratively or in the courts? In the context of the corporate responsibility, you ask yourself, well, we've got plenty of rights, but how do you enforce them? And by that, I mean the corporations will tend to be subject to norms, rules, either that they create or that they embrace or that they view as customarily applicable to them, and it's applicable to them either because, this is in addition to laws to which they will be subject in whatever area they're operating, they're applicable to them either because they have chosen to bind themselves to it or because they know that there are adverse consequences if they fail to do it. So, for example, it may be possible to obey the laws of a particular state that has such a low minimum wage that it's almost laughable, and so you're complying with law, but that your consumers or your investors would view this as horrific because you really ought to be paying a more sustainable wage, and that may have repercussions on your ability to market your products or may affect adversely your cost of capital, and so you're going to adopt these norms. These are what John Ruddy would have called what he calls the social license, and what I call social norms or corporate governance regimes that may bind corporations because of the adverse consequences of failing to adhere to them, but with respect to which there's no law which you can use to haul these entities into court. And so in a lot of instances, civil society has been very critical of this, and also in this context of the second pillar, precisely because they don't see any law here. And because they don't see any law, they don't trust this to actually work and work efficiently.
Well, it strikes me as I listen to you and as I try to understand the development of this phenomena of an attempt to specify a global a concept of global corporate social responsibility or international corporate social responsibility, that if one comes to this area from an expertise or an interest in narrow traditional domestic areas of law, like if you're interested in securities law or you practice securities law, or even in the Delaware general corporate law, the Delaware general corporation law, if that is your concept of what law is or should look like in terms of highly specific requirements and remedies and statutes and cases interpreting the statutes, that you're inevitably going to be disappointed if you're trying to fit your appreciation of what's happening on the international scene into that box, which is legitimately narrow when we think about what we mean by law and what we want law to do, but that there might also be legitimacy and utility to the broader, messier concept dynamic that we see in the international arena. So, you know, I hear you talking about confusion and contradiction and uncertainty that nevertheless, by the Ruggie-led project, is being dragged along into a articulation of at least a vision, at least a framework that may have some real substantive impact on the lives of human beings around the planet. But I want to... go ahead, please.
Well, no, that's absolutely right. Just a couple of little tiny points.
Yeah.
One is that whether we like it or not, we're being dragged into this in any case. The American Bar Association, for example, has recognized the Ruggie principles applicable not just to your clients, but to lawyers themselves.
Uh-huh.
And that the even the Americans, think about Dodd-Frank and the conflict minerals, have begun to be working to change the law, especially with respect to transparency and disclosure, to bring some of these elements into what had been these more hermetically sealed areas, Delaware corporate law or federal securities law. So there's a bleeding in now that you're going to see more and more and more of. And in any case, as a lawyer who is representing these large corporations who are worried about this in the context of their global operations, there is no way that you can, as even as a by-the-book corporate lawyer or a by-the-book securities lawyer, you're not going to be able to escape getting brushing up against this stuff.
That's very interesting. So it is a matter of actual pressing importance, even for lawyers who are operating or see themselves only operating in the area of domestic law. This vision is incorporated into domestic law by participation of the United States in this process.
Right. And the United States and others as well. Right. There's an interesting story, if I can have 30 seconds.
Yeah.
There's Vedanta Corporation, for example, in England, learned this, in effect, the hard way. They complied with all law. They had a mining operation in a downstream subsidiary in India. They followed all the law, the corporate law, the securities laws. It was done very nicely. And in a way that I certainly would have done myself if I had been representing them. We had a downstream subsidiary and a joint venture. They got all the permits. They followed all the laws. They took the case all the way up to the Indian Supreme Court. And then a small civil society group filed a proceeding against them before the national contact point in the UK against the parent corporation, alleging actions and violations of the OECD's multinational guidelines for human rights, mm-hmm. which is absolutely voluntary and non-binding. There's no judicial precedent. The NCP, the National Contact Point, found against them. Mm-hmm. The company essentially laughed them off, said, well, you have no binding authority, and in any case, we complied with law. And what ultimately wound up happening was the political storm that was created was so strong that eventually the operations were shut down.
Uh-huh.
And so when you look at these things, which is why I say that you worry, it's no longer the business of lawyers, especially in the international context, to worry only about law, black letter law and legal cultures. This kind of stuff will seep in, and sometimes for your clients, which is why a lot of this is client driven, it will affect your clients in very palpable ways.
I have to admit that when I, going back to my law school days and certainly today, when I encounter the phrase soft law, I reach for my wallet. as a lawyer, and a legal scholar, I want to know what's law, and I want to know what's and I certainly have an appreciation for the influence of culture and morality and ethics, but I like I like the term culture, morality, ethics on the one hand and law on the other, and I'm prepared to see them interacting. But I get nervous when this phrase soft law is invited to the table. Can you disabuse me then? Perhaps you already have, but can you say a bit more about the operation of this phrase and concept of soft law?
Oh, sure, sure. Soft law is a pejorative term.
And for me,
I gave a lecture about this in Florence a couple of years ago, and we went over the way in which there's a subtle pejorativeness to the discourse that kind of hides the reality of what law is and is becoming. So when you refer to something as soft law, what you're really saying is, aha, we've got a set of regulations or a regulatory scheme and structure which falls outside of the structures of the law state. But in saying that, we also are embracing an assumption, and that assumption is that the only legitimate place where law can be created, law and governance structures can be created, and the only legitimate place where these legal and governance structures can be remedied would have to be within the state. And yet we know the reality is that is not the case. When you're dealing with businesses and with transactions that cross borders, in increasing situations, the actors who are engaging in these activities find themselves in a gap between states, beyond them. And for many of them, they have begun to develop their own legal and governance structure. Now, how do you do this? Well, you create soft law, and then people just turn their ears off. But if you think about it, what they're really doing is saying, aha, we need something to guide our work. How are we going to do this? Well, we're going to mimic the state, but we're going to be outside of the state. And how are we going to do this if I'm a transnational corporation? I'm going to create my own set of governance over a community of actors who are going to be part of my governance community. And in the case, for example, of Apple, that may mean, well, huh, I've got to create a series of products. I've got manufacturers downstream in 17 different countries. They have their own downstream suppliers, and I've got to figure out a way, and I don't want, as Apple discovered, for example, with the Foxconn people in China, I don't want bad things that they do to come and blow back on me and therefore affect my market share and the like. So how do I do that? Well, I create soft law. Well, what does soft law mean? Apple creates a governance system around contracts and its contract relations with all of the people in the supply chain, right, in which they set global standards for conduct involving the creation and transmission of goods up the supply chain. And in this case, it's a supplier code of conduct, which deals with everything from labor conduct to environmental issues to anti-corruption to financial concerns. It gives Apple the right to both train, intervene, remediate violations of their supplier code downstream. When you look at this from outside, you say, well, there's no law here. This is all soft law. They've got the supplier code. They've got these contractual arrangements. But when you're inside, what you see is the creation of a regulatory system that is actually binding among the parties, right, but not emanating from a state nor necessarily remedied through the apparatus of states, arbitrators, or courts and the like. And so in this context, when you say soft law, you really have to say it's a non-state governance system that you're dealing with its own logic and its own system for remedies and discipline, usually around contracts, but not necessarily.
Well,
they can be quite effective.
Let me pursue that example to ask you about the power of this concept or this instrument, if we might even think of it that way, in the international domain. It's a little, Apple is doing, it's not just a set of contracts an amalgam of private ordering when Apple sets up these relationships with its suppliers and subsidiaries and supply chain globally, right? That if it was just that they're having this series of contracts and setting up their own system for enforcing, adjudicating, that just looks like private ordering or private law. But they're also they also are setting up a kind of set of expectations or norms or demands that we might expect to come to apply to other corporations that didn't necessarily set it up specifically with the intentionality that Apple did, right? They're setting up a practice or a soft law, now I'm using the term, that will come to regulate not just their operations, but corporations that are operating in the international context, maybe in the tech world generally. Is that right?
That's actually right too, because what will wind up happening is not only are you setting up your own, you're setting yourself up as a kind of mini state with a population that includes all of the actors in your supply chain, and then you're dealing with governance. I call them governance contracts, but they really are the private law systems. But by doing that, you're also creating within industries a set of customs and expectations that then become quite influential. Mm-hmm. And so it's not surprising, for example, to see that Target and Walmart and Kmart will, in their approaches to regulating globally their operations, will tend to look at what each of them are doing, and sometimes will actually create industry-wide standards, which they then apply privately. And then sometimes they rely on third-party standard makers. In the case of Apple, when they got into trouble, right, they reached out to the Fair Labor Association and agreed to abide by their standards as the normative basis for constructing their own private ordering. So, yeah, there's a kind of trans-corporate effect to this, right. The way you view, in a sense, it's somewhat similar to state multilateralism, but a little different because it's very focused. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can't expect, in these kinds of relationships, you kind of look and you say, well, they're kind of sort of acting like states, but they're really not acting like states because they're not asserting the same broad range of powers in the same way. So that if they're like deficient states, and therefore if they're deficient or defective, they can't be states, and therefore what they're doing really isn't up to snuff in terms of its legitimacy, in terms of its enforceability, and therefore we're going to sneer at it as somehow flawed. I think that is perhaps not the best way of looking at it. It's extraordinary to me that in the context of a world that is just full of states and law, that these large enterprises have been able to carve out fairly significant spaces in which their regulations and their approaches become preeminent.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me follow up on this and from a kind of a critical perspective, and then I want to ask you another question about the three pillars. But let me suggest this critique, the following critique of the whole enterprise, and you tell me why I'm wrong or why there might be something to it.
Right. Or you may be right.
Well, this isn't my view, but it's a right. view that I want to give voice to.
Sure.
That very often in the domestic context, what we see is that that industries emerge, that they come on the scene, they're relatively unregulated. They come to have a dominant presence in a given market or in the culture as a whole, and then government begins to get interested or develop regulations. To constrain the operations of the business or to set guidelines for the operation of the business in whatever domain it might be. And we take a little bit of a closer look, and what we often see, what at first looks to be ironic, is we often see that it's the leading businesses or the leading corporations are themselves pushing for the development of a regulatory regime. And that looks, Pollyanna-ish. Is Pollyanna the one that's happy? I'm not sure. Yes, I think Pollyanna.
Yeah.
Pollyanna-ish perspective. You say, oh, well, that's wonderful. It's business cooperating with government to establish a legitimate regulatory atmosphere. But the critical perspective sees that actually what's happening is business is working through government to create barriers to entry into their field to protect their market share or even to create monopoly power and enjoy monopoly rents. So we see the most powerful corporations are often the ones that are most aggressively pushing for the regulation of the industry in order to keep entrants out, competitors out, which hurts other corporations and ultimately hurts, one might argue, consumers, as we don't get competitive prices. It hurts workers. We don't get competitive wages, and there's a real social loss. Is that dynamic? So when I read about this area, there I see a lot of excitement about the cooperation of multinational corporations in the development of the Ruggie regime, and that sort of skepticism about regulation antenna kind of comes up and say, well, I wonder, why are they so cooperative? Is it because, that Apple is so aggressive in developing these expectations because it actually helps to solidify their dominant place in the market?
All right. And the answer is, it's kind of funny. Part of the answer is, yes, you're absolutely right. And the critical perspective is absolutely right. Businesses, to the extent that one can engage in furthering a particular policy objective that then has some consequential additional benefit, in this case, anti-competitive benefit, sure, that's going to make them even more excited. And to some extent, that's the case. Mm-hmm. But here's the problem. Here's the problem. That argument was much more powerful before the 1990s than it is now. And the reason for that is that with globalization, you now have a very, very odd situation. You've got effectively free movement of capital and investment everywhere, more or less. Depending on how you look at it, it's a little uneven, and you can quibble about the stuff, and the bits make things a little strange, and regional trade associations, blah, 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 blah. But compared to the period before, let's say 1995, capital tends and investment tends to move fairly freely all over the place. Mm-hmm. Labor remains locked in national monopolistic territories. And there's a variety of very good reasons for that. Labor is very special. It involves individuals. You're dealing with the construction of a democratic state, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In that context, using the state to create these kind of regulatory barriers only works to the extent that your competitors can't go, or market entrants can't go somewhere else and then bring goods in, which is essentially what's been happening with greater regularity since the mid-1990s. So to some extent, yeah, that will be a driver, but it's a less effective driver now that, you know, I can regulate all I want in Germany, but if I'm regulating, for example, in the area of labor, and the environmental concerns to some extent, and I don't like it, I will go to Belarus, or I will go to Turkey, or I will go to Cameroon. And if the transportation costs make this a sensible decision, there I go, and the goods will come in. We had this in the United States. Of course, we've seen this in the waves in the 80s. It was Japanese goods that came in, then the Asian tigers, and then China. And this continues. I mean, China has its own pricing problems now. They're moving factories from the eastern seaboard inland because of these things. So, yeah. So to some extent, yes, it's true. But to a larger extent, I think, especially among the larger companies, this is less an issue because you can effectively move, depending on how much money you're going to make by doing this and how much it's going to cost you, you can move your operation. And indeed, as Halliburton suggested, you can, if things get really dicey, even move your headquarters if it makes a difference because regulations appear to be somewhat incompatible with your own views. So, yeah, you can use them, but people move around. I think that in this case, though, what drives the larger companies to do this is that a company would, especially a large company that's got a lot of money on the table, a large company operates more efficiently if they understand the risk parameters that they face in their operations than if they don't. Mm-hmm. And I think a decision was made that if you can create a set of global architecture within which you can identify and manage risk, mm-hmm. that's a better situation for large multinationals than one in which all bets are off. And you've got a bunch of actors going around, especially state actors with very little capacity and very little sophistication, or that may be somewhat unstable. That's not the kind of world where business can be at its most efficient and therefore at its most financially productive. They would much rather see a stable architecture. And I think that's what you're seeing here. And indeed, for businesses, at least when I've heard them, There's a lot of talk about the architecture in terms of its effects on managing, of identifying, managing, and reducing risk. Mm-hmm. And so from that perspective, this becomes a good thing. And while it may continue to have, to some extent, anti-competitive elements, I think that the risk management part of it inures to the benefit of all, both the current operators and potential entrants, at least at this high level. Right. So that's my best shot.
Well, the question is really ultimately an empirical. I think it's ultimately an empirical one. I mean, we can the theoretical assessment is rather flippable, but the ultimate question is, I know it's early in the day yet for this regime, but what is the impact on the intersection of human rights and corporate operations? Is there an improvement, are we seeing this regime actually pay dividends in terms of human rights?
Right, and that's absolutely right, because at some point all of this is going to have to be data driven. I hate the phrase, but it's the phrase of the decade, so I'm going to use it too.
I'm skeptical too, and we can drop a footnote to say that, you know, you can count, but it's hard to know exactly what you're counting and what counts as human flourishing, what counts as well-being is ultimately perhaps not an empirical question, but in some sense it's an empirical question, right?
Right, and whether or not it's empirical or not, we are going to be using data to drive our politics, and we can argue premises, we can argue all of that stuff, the empirical element of this is critical. I think it is a little early in the day. The few empirical studies I've seen have been all over the board. Some of them suggest a net small negative, some of them a net small positive, some of them aren't even sure. It's too early, and there are not enough companies yet that I think are really doing this for a long enough period to generate numbers and conclusions that I think are robust. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think to the extent that businesses can view it, and this is in a sense part of an ongoing project, at least from the perspective of some civil society actors that are trying to make this happen in the second pillar, to the extent that businesses can begin to regularize their accounting for human rights the way they have regularized their accounting for the financial performance of the company generally, I think that they will be much more likely to embrace this, and it will be easier to determine what is working and what is not than under the current kind of anarchic regime where we've got a lot of theory and a lot of ideology floating around on all sides, left, right, center, up and down, and very little to show for it.
Right. Of course, the formalization of financial accounting and reporting does not preclude financial calamity, as we've recently seen, and no doubt the formalization of accounting and reporting with respect to human rights won't. I guess Ruggie in his book says there is no silver bullet, and this regime won't preclude catastrophe in the human rights area as well. Might improve.
And that is that's right. And that is absolutely right. And of course, you know, one of the problems is that kind of thing drives certain civil society actors absolutely crazy. And one of the difficulties here is actually getting states, businesses, and civil society actors, especially those deeply committed to human rights, to actually talk to each other using words that they can understand. For civil society actors, there's no compromise here.
Right.
The point of this is you have to view this as a black-white thing. You're either doing it or you're not, and if you're violating, you've got to fix it. For businesses, you're looking at this from the perspective of risk and and the normative mechanics for dealing with risk since the 1930s has been disclosure and then markets with a kind of backup set of foundational disciplinary parameters. And then for states, it's kind of policy issues involving both national advantage and the need for international cooperation. And to get the three of them together to actually agree on something becomes very, very difficult. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that in this area before anything that begins to look like a consensus develops.
Uh-huh. Well, when you talk about, I appreciate the risk paradigm through which multinational corporations are addressing the issue, but that raises the question that I wanted to put to you. The question is, risk of what? And I think ultimately for these corporations, it's risk of it's risk of financial return or risk of the bottom line from the shareholder perspective. So what I want to ask is whether or not there is a part of this movement internationally endeavors to address an issue that we often discuss on this podcast, and that is the legitimacy of the shareholder primacy or the shareholder exclusivity norm in corporate governance itself. Is there a look inside of corporate governance law as a remedy to the problem of international corporate social responsibility?
Well, thank you for asking the question. That is, of course, the elephant in the room, and it's been an elephant in the room that some people sometimes acknowledge much more so on the business side than on civil society side. And here, I'm afraid that there is a lot more development that has to occur. Mm-hmm. Businesses have tended to use the shareholder primacy or the enterprise primacy model, financial welfare enterprise primacy model, as a shield to resist a lot of movement. Civil society tends to view the stakeholder model as the absolute core necessity to move us out of the traditional deficiencies in business engagement with human rights, and that therefore is a necessary first step in order to get businesses to do it right, and they need tremendous resistance on the business side. Mm-hmm. States tend to, the model over the past century has been what the model is, and they tend to support business with some exceptions. I mean, you've seen this in the U.S., the rise of the new benefit corporation statutes in England, and in some states, a nod to a stakeholder model in some of the amendments to some of the corporate statutes, although most of those are fairly anemic. But they're nice gestures. This is a core problem, and until this is not resolved, until there's some movement here, I think you're going to continue to have this kind of face-off, because in a sense, to get to where civil society wants to get, you are effectively going to have to abandon a shareholder or enterprise primacy model. On the other hand, if you abandon a shareholder primacy model, you will substantially impact, and probably in very adverse ways, the construction of our global economic order that has, in its own ways, and subject to all of the tremendous flaws that we can talk about, has brought a tremendous amount of positive benefit to states and individuals over the course of the last century. And so getting to, and you can tell, I'm sitting on the fence.
Somebody needs to, Larry, and I appreciate you sitting on the fence, because I think my intellectual prejudice is to say that the fundamental problem is in corporate governance, and the remedies will inevitably be, to use your elegant word, anemic. The remedies will inevitably be anemic until we address that fundamental governance problem. But you know, you're sitting on the fence, forcing me and proponents of that view to respect the utility of the global economic order that has developed under the shareholder primacy norm is a challenge. It comes, from you sitting on that fence forces us to appreciate that there is a great threat, a great risk in departing from that central organizing principle.
So that's right. And so now that doesn't mean that, and here's a problem that I've seen, there's some writers who have actually been very good. I'm not going to remember names, but some people have suggested, and I think that they're onto something here, that there's a difference between understanding the basic utility of a shareholder wealth maximization or an enterprise wealth maximization model, and then taking that to an utterly insane extreme. Mm-hmm. I think that even if you embrace a shareholder welfare maximization model, it doesn't necessarily mean that that ought to entitle you not just to maximize shareholder wealth, but to do it in a way that then decreases the wealth, or essentially free rides on the deleterious effects to the other elements that make up corporate operations. And what may need to happen is perhaps not to get away from the shareholder wealth model, but to understand that the way in which you arrive at the calculus of that wealth may have to include sensitivities to the deleterious effects of the actions undertaken to get there in ways that we don't do yet.
Right, right. And even that, I think, would be an enormous improvement. You know, if you might say that the bedrock fiduciary principle will be oriented towards shareholder wealth development, but other stakeholders, even if they don't have a right to have their interests pursued, they have a right to have their interests or the impact of corporate operations aired in the boardroom, you know, deliberated on, understood in such a way that it will, in soft fashion, perhaps, influence the orientation of directorial decision making.
Well, that's right. And here, let me give you an even cruder example. What if, for example, and this will work in the U.S., it'll work less well somewhere else. What happens, for example, if all of a sudden you decide, oh, okay, I like the shareholder wealth model, it makes sense, but everyone has a property right in their human rights. Mm-hmm. So that if a corporation acts in ways that negatively impacts an individual's human rights, what they've effectively done is bought it to the extent that they have reduced its value. Mm-hmm. And that therefore a corporation must, is part of their calculus for the net profit, their operating margin, they're going to have to take into account the cost of the property taking that they have done by affecting adversely the human rights of any number of people that they've affected. You do that, you still have preserved, in a sense, the shareholder primacy model, but now corporations will have to pay for their use of and their need to remediate abuses of human rights as part of their basic calculus for determining, well, what's their profit margin? What's their profit margin?
Right, right.
You know, even something simple like that,
yeah.
Which requires a change in the conception of property. Now, the problem
well, that's
is, of course,
it's conceptually simple, Larry, but it's conceptually simple, yeah. But that sounds mechanically cumbersome.
Oh, of course. my suggestion is, I'm not using this podcast as an opportunity to unveil this extraordinary new insight, but to sort of suggest that if, in fact, we begin to think about the relationships of a corporation and its stakeholders or the universe in which it operates, perhaps a little more creatively, it might be possible without undermining the fundamental principle of shareholder wealth maximization to do it in a way that's more sensitive to the realities of the ways in which businesses operate in the context that is respectful of human rights.
That I think you've really put your finger on it. That is the subtle challenge to intellectual workers, to activists, to politicians. That is the nuanced challenge that we need to attend to if we really want to improve corporate social responsibility in multiple domains, and I think you've articulated it very squarely. We're coming to the end of our time, and but I want to ask you if you know, in light of that, the acknowledgement of that outstanding challenge, what do you see coming? Where do you see this project going, and where would you like to see it go to continue to develop in an effective way?
All right, I see a couple of things going in the context of states. I think you're going to see substantially more engagement by states in the business of human rights. I think it's going to be very uneven, but I think you're going to see greater attention paid. And I suspect that the big focus of activity beyond creating a quote-unquote human rights architecture, and you don't have to call it human rights, that for some people that just sends them off into outer space, mm-hmm. a rights-sensitive or a state obligation to its own people to maximize their aggregate welfare principle, whatever you want to call it. There's going to be, besides that, I think the focus is going to be both on disclosure and on compliance. In some countries, that is going to involve a significant refocus on corruption. In other countries, it's going to involve now John Knox at Wake Forest is now working on viewing, for example, environmental interactions by states or businesses as human rights impactful. You're going to see it in environmental context as well. The second pillar, the corporate responsibility, I think you're going to see a lot more and fairly diversified and I think much more sophisticated efforts at reporting. And you're going to see much more sophisticated efforts at creating alternative and autonomous standards for business conduct that starts with compliance with local law, but then is going to move beyond that in ways that companies, I think, will view as mitigating their risks, both their social risk and their legal risk, and then putting them in changing the business culture in ways that will make this problem not disappear, but become less of a threat to them in ways that they would not like to see this threatened. And by threatening, I mean affecting their ability to operate profitably. The big issue, I think, for the next 5 to 10 years is going to have to be on the remedial wing. It's easy enough to talk all of this stuff, but how are you going to actually make it possible for someone sitting in a rural village in a developing state who has been affected by a downstream activity of a global enterprise to figure out how he's been affected, what sorts of rights he has, where he can go to make a complaint, and how he can get this remedied without driving his family into poverty, and with the positive expectation that in a reasonable way he's going to be able to vindicate his rights, or he's going to get the state to adhere to their obligations. The last big thing, and this is really the big problem for the next 10 years, is how to get away from the jargon of human rights, which has become so ideologically charged that a lot of people just blank out when you use the HR words, mm-hmm. even corporate social responsibility. So I think you're going to be seeing a lot of efforts to translate this into the normative language that's used within governance communities. This will be especially true in places like China, but also in the United States, where you say human rights and people from a particular ideological perspective just go bonkers.
Right. Well, I really appreciate that point as well. It's almost when you read in this area, you almost have to adopt to a new language. I mean, you're reading English, I'm reading it in English, but it's the language is so idiosyncratic that it's either ideologically charged, as you described, or it's so denuded of ideology that it you have to read and reread the words to even find out what the content is. So I appreciate the need for an enrichment of the language that we use to discuss these issues, and that language will perhaps carry us along to more to ever more sophisticated and useful regulatory regimes.
Right, and that is probably the most insightful thing that we have said in this conversation, and I really want to thank you for that. Well, that is ultimately the basic problem. If we do not understand what we're talking about, and if we can't get someone who isn't, you know, who's got 10 or 15 years experience in this language to try to understand, if we cannot get a simple common language to understand this stuff, this project is going to go nowhere.
Well, I think you've helped in developing that, even in this conversation today. So I'm enormously grateful to you, Larry, and I hope you'll join us for another podcast soon down the road as your work in this area continues to develop and as the project itself develops.
Well, thank you very much for just a delightful conversation. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, that's it. That's our conversation with Larry Kotob-Backer on international corporate social responsibility. What a nice guy, thoughtful guy, and really helped, I think, to make me more sensitive to the really powerful, productive, positive work that's being done in this area. When I was thinking about doing this interview, I have to admit that my own prejudice was that I assumed that the entire RUGI project, the entire protect, respect, remedy paradigm that is being developed in the area of international social responsibility within the auspices of the United Nations, I had assumed that it was undoubtedly very weak, anemic, not a serious response to the depth of the problem of corporate irresponsibility in our world. But I think I've been disabused of that prejudice, and now myself have greater respect and appreciation for the enormity of the challenge and the sincerity of the response that is being undertaken by individuals in within the UN apparatus, within the corporate community, within the activist community that is developing this still very nascent, still very admittedly soft or weak, but real, genuine, positive development. I don't know. Maybe I'll go back to thinking otherwise as I learn more about it. But I'm buoyed at the moment. I hope you are too. Or if you came in to this conversation having a very strong view about the usefulness of this project, maybe we've suggested to you that it's weaker than it really is. We'll return to it as I learn more, as things develop. In the meantime, keep doing the great thinking that you're doing, the great work you're doing. I'll talk to you next time.